Rush, as I mentioned in the ad, is an Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Anthropology at the Australian National University. And in our exchange together about Yasmin's work, Mati said this about her. She said, Yasmin is versatile. She's written about boredom, joking, human-animal relations, monsters, smoke, sleep, death, personhood, and a range of other topics. And Mati believes, and I fully agree, that this versatility is based on exceptionally good ethnographic work among the Walbiri people in Australia's Northern Territory near Alice Springs. Though it's not, to me, it's not only that. There are many excellent ethnographers in anthropology, but it takes a particular kind of feel for the people, the place, the engagement with being alive that has made it possible for Yasmin to make original and rigorous contributions to both towards ongoing debates and topics that nobody else has really picked up. She writes in an exceptionally engaging way. For example, she was one of the first people in anthropology to seriously engage with the idea of boredom back in 2007 in an article called Boredom, Time and Modernity, an example from Aboriginal Australia. In an article that was a groundbreaking read for me, and still outdoes 99% of the work on boredom and waiting written since the temporal term began. Her work on Walbiri dog stories, for its part, is both Mati's and mine and Ilana's recommended reading for the anthropology of human-animal relations. Today's topic connects with her best-known project, Monster Anthropology, which at least started out as a focus on various culturally specific concerns or fears. Her latest book, which is edited with Ilana Gershon, who's well known to us here in Helsinki, neither of us have had the chance to read it yet, because I think it's only just out.
Just,
yeah. We don't know, either Mati or I, how monster anthropology has evolved in that book. But the comparative study of monsters has been hugely popular, and our students have loved monster anthropology too, by the way. Yasmin herself has said that one of the things she's most proud of is, of her recent publication, she's published many things, is a special issue of the Australian Journal of Anthropology called Settler Colonial Violence in Contemporary Australia. It was published 3 years ago, volume 33, special issue number one. And I won't list all the other things. Oh, and last but not least, Mati wanted to mention, Yasmin is a member of the editorial board of Suomen Anthropologia. And with no further ado, I'm going to hand over to Yasmin on monsters and crises. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks everyone for showing up, and thanks to Mati, who I hope will recover very quickly. This is super exciting for me because lots of my friends have been here and this is my very first time, and I'm just really keen to meet you all and hear what you have to say. Just excited. And also, this is my first day back at work after 4 months of long service leave, so what a cool day to start work with. Thanks. I will get straight into it and I will read a lot of it because it's jam-packed with stuff, so I don't lose my way. Okay, this paper has two aims. The first one is to introduce the project of monster anthropology that Geir Prestrudstrand, who was here as well, wasn't he? Did Geir come and visit?
Yes.
And I have been working on for over a decade now. And so that's the first monster book, that's Monster Anthropology 2, and that's the one that Ilana and me just got out. The difference between, I'll talk about the first two a lot. The difference between the first two and the third one is that the third one is actually ethnographic fiction. So these ones are academic, and the one with Ilana is all short stories about real monsters. It's pretty fun, Ilana and me think. We are also having a current third, Jeremy, having a current third project, and take this as a call to everyone. If you have any monster papers you want to contribute, send them through. Like, one of the cool things about giving monster papers all around the place is that we get contributors from everywhere as well. So if you have anything, let me know. Okay, so I'll start with what we mean by monster anthropology and where we're at right now. The second part of the paper is to illustrate how an anthropological focus on monsters adds new perspectives to the ways we live in, with, and through crises. Specifically, I focus on three monsters today that haunt Walpi people. Walpi people are the people I do all my research with in Central Australia, and three types of crises that these three monsters respectively are associated with. And then you can kind of see how the monsters and the crises and different views on these kind of help us see even more entanglements in the world that we live in. Okay, to start, monster studies, not monster anthropology, monster studies is a relatively young field. Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's Monster Culture 7 thesis constitutes something of a foundation to the concerted interdisciplinary effort of studying monsters. And this is from 1996. He posits that monsters are born at metaphoric crossroads as an embodiment of a certain cultural moment of a time, a feeling, or place. As a medievalist, his understanding of the crossroads and of the monsters is naturally metaphoric. The monster anthropology Gare and I are developing marries the premise of the monster as meaning generating with ethnographic fieldwork. The latter tends to present anthropologists with contexts where monsters are anything but metaphors, even while the monsters themselves still very much are, as Halberstam puts it, meaning machines. Clearly, what counts as monstrous does not mean the same for everyone. What is monstrous differs over time and across cultures. And yet, there's a distinct family resemblance these creatures share, distilled also in the etymology of the English term monster, which originates from the Latin monstrum, which twins two verbs, monere, to warn or to admonish, and demonstrare, to reveal, to show, or to indicate, which in tandem create a sense of an embodied portent or omen. Monsters were always indicators of strangeness and often of danger. So in antiquity, you had them populating the ends of the map, indicating danger there. And you all know the, you know, dragons, giants, mermaids, and so on, that lurked in the borderlands between the known and the unknown. Since then, the world has shifted, and many other worlds exist apart from antiquity, and monsters have transformed over and over again. And that is something that in monster studies is looked at a lot, like, you know, how do monsters transform with times and history. Gare and I propose that monster is a useful umbrella term. Firstly, it allows us to gather, to contrast, and to compare ethnographies of a great variety of different beings that otherwise would not be considered in the same conceptual space. And secondly, employing the term then allows interdisciplinary engagement with the rich emerging field of monster studies itself. So monster studies does its thing, anthropology looks at monsters that people actually live with, and then combine the theory and the ethnographic monsters, and you get what we do. The main point we make over and over is that, as opposed to the monsters in interdisciplinary monster studies, which are imaginary beings that stand for something else, our monsters deeply affect the lives of those they haunt. Taking seriously how the monstrous manifests locally and documenting the socio-cultural specific ways in which people relate to monsters then reveals how people understand themselves, their world, and their position within it. In this vein, contributors to the first monster anthropology volume, this one, worked on ethnographically detailing first what we call the indeterminacy of monster realities, Second, the particularities of the monstrous body. Third, how monsters are contingent on the humans they haunt. And fourth, monsters and change. The last issue was so productive that it turned into the basis for the second volume. Agreeing with Cohn that monsters indeed are embodiments of cultural moments, there we put forward that through cross-cultural comparison, anthropology is ideally positioned to examine exactly how monsters relate to change. By tying the monster more closely to time, we explored social change to the following processes. And I'll give you a very quick example of each of these. So for emergence, consider the Andean Pishtaco, a monstrous version of the white man evolving out of and representing conquest, colonization, and neocolonialism, which was described by Mary Weissmantle as a terrifying bogeyman who waylays Indian travelers in order to drain the fat from their bodies. He then sells the human fat to other whites. The latter use it to manufacture industrial goods, ranging from pharmaceuticals and processed foods to rocket fuel, skin creams, and scented soaps. So, brilliant example of monster emergence. For adaptation, think no further than Rupert Stash's work on the spirits of coral white dead from West Papua, moving to Singapore. For appropriation, a really brilliant example is the Australian Bunyip, which is the only Aboriginal monster that is known across mainstream Australia and used to be a highly localized river-dwelling monster from South Australia, and then the colonizers took it out of the river and progressively relegated it to books, children's books, cuddly toys, and chocolate. For amalgamation, think of the Algonquian Wendigo. At home in the boreal forests of North America, the Wendigo is a supernatural being whose gaunt figure, insatiable hunger, tattered lips, and superhuman strength embody deep-seated fears about isolation and hunger. With Contact, the French-Canadian belief in werewolves provided voyageurs with a framework to understand Wendigos in French-Canadian terms, and the Wendigo became bulkier, more hirsute, and in some instances only haunting at the full moon. So they kind of merge. For Extinction, there's like, and you know, for each of these, there's squazillions of examples. Missionization, logging, the introduction of electricity, monocultures, pastoralism, deforestation, and other kinds of habit destruction seem to produce parallel pathways of extinction for flora, fauna, and monsters, as detailed, for example, by Anna Singh and her contributors. And for Succession, which goes back to what I said before, is huge in monster studies. For anthropology, consider Michael Dillon Foster's work on yokai in Japan, in which he focuses on the specific ways in which yokai change as socio-cultural contexts change. And so you kind of have real parallels there. So ethnographically examining monsters in contexts of social transformation brought forward new insights from which we embarked on our current project, conceptualizing the planet as a monster biome. In Foster's words, who wrote the afterword to the second monster volume, quote, just as the microbiome opens up new avenues for thinking about biological selfhood through the invisible agents that define it, so too the monster biome allows us to take into account invisible forces that affect and define who we are. So in this vein, monster anthropology proposes thinking about the world as co-constituted through entangled living and being. In this, our current approach joins others, such as multi-species studies and environmental humanities, in a concerted effort to find novel and hopefully deeper understandings of the current cultural moment of planetary crisis. And to give you an example, I now go into the three monsters and crises. At Yundamu, I didn't want to cross it out, I wanted to underline it. This is where Yundamu is. So there's a map of all of Australia. This is the Northern Territory. So this is Central Australia. And the bit in red there is the Tanami Desert, which is the traditional lands of Walpi people. So I work with Walpi people at Yundamu specifically, which is one of their settlements, and across the Tanami Desert more broadly. At Yundamu, I learned what it means to live with monsters, or kuku, as Wolpe people call them. At Yundamu, kuku are everywhere. They are invoked to frighten children from strolling too far from camp. They live in houses, they live behind that big tree in West Camp, and definitely next to the airstrip. Some kuku can ensorcel you, others can kill you or rape you. Others again will trick you or tease you, confuse you, protect you, or make you laugh. There are many different kinds of kuku: milalpa, localized guardian spirits, mingle pinji, the flat and hairless inhabitants of the southern salt lakes, rainbow serpents, and the lonely giantess just down the road from Yundamu. I also learned that just one dust devil, or Willy Willy, might be just that, a dust devil, but that another one, the one traveling along an erratic path, might be a monster that made itself otherwise invisible. I learned that Walbre people distinguish between storm clouds coming in and an angry rainbow serpent tracking somebody from the sky, and between different sounds in the bush, always aware which bird songs or types of whistling signal supernatural dangers and which ones signal safety. In the 1950s, Mervyn Maggott meticulously documented everything he found out about one particular monster called Jamba at the newly established government ration depot, then called Hooker Creek, now called Lajamanu, which is about 500 kilometers northwest of Yundamu, still in the Tanami, or on the border of the Tanami. Jamba, he says, have, quote, many human qualities and frailties, but really are, quote again, malicious, indeed malevolent beings, who on occasion seem to be wholly immaterial and to possess miraculous powers. Jamba have companion birds, wear feather shoes, and kill people. They look like humans, but wild, with darker skin than that of Wolpe people, and their bodies covered in red ochre. They have red eyes and matted hair standing on end. They are left-handed. All Jamba are male and have huge penises, always partially erect. Their language sounds like whistling, but they can also speak Wolpe. To most humans, they're invisible. However, Nankari, which is the Wolpe word for medicine, men or women, can see them, as can dogs, who often warn Wolpe people about the presence of Jamba and may also attack and sometimes defeat them. Jamba have their own homes where they keep their abducted human wives, and their offspring is always male and always Jamba. They can fly as fast as a bullet. This, combined with their invisibility, allows them to steal, rape, and kill without being seen. The Jamba is not a cannibal. He kills for the sheer pleasure it gives him. This proclivity of Jamba to kill while unseen offered Wolpe people who do not believe in natural death, except in the case of very young and very old people. So if a child and children didn't used to get names, individual names, until they were like 3 or 4. So if a child before it was named passes away, it's just understood to have gone back into the dreaming. And if a very old senile person who again loses their name passes away, they kind of go back into the dreaming. So those are natural deaths, and any death of people who are not children and not very old senile people is an unnatural death, and it needs to be explained. It especially needs to be explained if it happens to someone, you know, between the ages of 35 and 55, when they're at their maximum seniority in terms of ritual and leadership and so on. So Jamba gave them a set of logical explanations for otherwise inexplicable deaths. The deceased, they say, had the bad luck of a chance encounter with a Jamba who used sorcery, which, unless countered by Nankari, manifests as incurable sickness leading to death. They can also use brute force, which is a sudden death. So you either have a slow death of sorcery or a sudden death of whatever, and it was a Jamba who did it. So this is why, according to Maggott, after nightfall, the Wolpe fear of them being Jamba, is quite apparent. This fear of Jamba has not changed over the 70 years since Maggott's research. as Jamba continued to kill for the sheer pleasure of it. At night, Yondamir resembles one of those medieval maps. The familiar houses and roads, noble and in place, are surrounded by unsafe spaces, which are avoided as Jamba are known to lurk there. At times, Jamba attack camps from these vantage points, which results in panicked moves from one house to another, or one end of Yondamir to the other, in the middle of the night. What has changed is that Jamba have acquired new skills. They now also speak English, they can drive cars, in fact, they drive black Toyotas, which is the exact opposite of white government Toyotas. They have access to the internet and are also known to stay in hotels, which then need to be avoided. Indeed, they have changed their residential patterns in a direct reversal with Walpi people. Whereas in the past, Walpi people were nomadic and Jamba had their set domains. Now Walpi people live in settlements and Jamba are drawn to their fringes and prowl around these settlements. So while in the past, the rare inexplicable death could be accredited to the misfortune of accidentally having crossed the path of a Jamba, today the inordinately high mortality rate of Walpi people is linked to Jamba being drawn to settlements. The settler colonial twist of this becomes starkly heightened when considering the issue of visibility. In the old days, Maggot reports, Nankari and dogs were the only ones able to see Jamba. Today, non-Indigenous people also can, and often do, see Jamba. Indeed, many Jamba haunts are known to Walpi people through information provided by non-Indigenous people. For example, people know there was a Jamba living in one of the deserted West Camp houses because non-Indigenous people mentioned being asked for cigarettes by what they took to be an Aboriginal man there. Walpi people knew that nobody lived there. In this, as in other Jamba sightings by non-Indigenous people at the airstrip, the roadhouse, in Alice Springs, the non-Indigenous person is not actually aware that they met a Jamba. They mistake the monster for an Aboriginal person and are not the least bit scared by the encounter. And the casual tone of Jamba engagements with non-Indigenous people, asking for a smoke, talking about the weather, the state of the roads, or whereabouts of certain Walpi individuals, suggests that Jamba, who kill for sheer pleasure, do not kill Indigenous people, non-Indigenous people, but Walpi people specifically. In the past, deaths happened rarely, and an accidental chance encounter with a Jamba served as a plausible explanation. Today, what begs for explanation are the number of deaths that Walpi communities experience. Contemporary Walpi people's life expectancy is much lower than it was in the past, and much lower than that of non-Indigenous people, who, by the way, do not die in the Tanami. In light of this, Walpi people's continued palpable fear of Jamba tells us to take seriously the very presence of Jamba and what it portends. Lastly, it is poignant to understanding of life in the settler colony. That their dogs provide Walpi people with better protection from what kills them than do non-Indigenous people, who are on best terms with their killers. And I'll move on to the next monster, which is called Pankalan. Taking that the Tanami is a monster biome, it struck me as incongruous when, in August 2013, Walpi people got terribly excited about a group of hairy cannibal monsters called Pankalang travelling past Yundamu. I was in Sydney at the time and my phone rang hot with calls from Yundamu. The Pankalang, it turned out to be a husband, a wife and a child, had first been sighted as they appeared a little distance east of Yundamu. Over the next days, people continued ringing with updates of the slow westward journey of the Pankalang family until the monsters disappeared into the depths of the Tanami. Mary Lou, a Walpi friend of mine in her mid-30s, mother of three grown children and one toddler, grandmother of two further toddlers, rang me more often than the others, resulting in deep conversations. To recognize where Mary Lou's thoughts were coming from requires an understanding that the world filled with kuku used to include Pankalang, but had not done so in Mary Lou's living memory. In fact, during her lifetime, and in sharp contrast to other kuku, Pangalang had become relegated to little more than just-so characters and just-so stories. The deeds of Pangalang are recited in Walpi stories, and these days are also depicted in Walpi school books. In one of these, the late Neville Jabonadi Paulson, artist and gifted storyteller, provides an illustration of a large, hairy Pangalang wielding a spiked club. It is accompanied by a description of the Pangalang as like a person, but very large, with huge feet, long claws, very big eyes, and a big head. The belly, back, and arms and legs are covered with hair. Pangalang are said to live in caves, to hunt at night and sleep during the day. They kill and devour other monsters, but also humans and other Pangalang. Many stories elaborate, especially on the Pangalang penchant for killing, cooking, and eating human children. Christine Nichols emphasizes two key points here. The first one is that Pangalang serve as a warning function for children not to lose their carers out of sight. And second, that the Pangalang way of killing, cooking, and consuming children is eerily reminiscent of the way in which Walpi people kill, cook, and consume guanas. Just like Walpi people grab the guana and bash its head against their digging stick, the Pangalang kills the child either by beating its head with a club or hitting it against a stone. Just as Walpi people cook guana in the hot coals of the fire, so do Pangalang with children. And just as Walpi people rip off a guana's leg or tail to eat, so do Pangalang rip off the cook's child appendages to munch on when they feel peckish. While Pangalang hunting techniques mirror those of humans, they fail to distinguish between consuming socially sanctioned edible meat and cannibalism. Further, their sociality lacks other key human attributes. They don't conduct initiations, they don't bury their dead, and so on. Pangalang stories are part of Jukurpa, or the dreaming as it is called in English, same as Janpa stories are, all the monster stories are. Jukurpa refers to the time of ancestral creation, during which the land, its hills, rivers, and plains, the animals, plants, people, clouds, winds, stars, fire, water, and indeed the monsters, were created. However, Jukurpa is not understood as a fixed time period, but, as so appositely coined by Stenner, as everywhen. In the Walpi context, Nancy Mann specifies that Jukurpa refers to the period of ancestral creation, to ancestral beings themselves, to the act of dreaming and dreams, and it is interlaced with the Walpi term Yijado, which means both the here and now and truth or reality. Mann's point is that Walpi people understand the dreaming to be Yijado in both senses, as real and as everywhen or now. Pangalang are Yijado in the same way. They exist in the everywhen and they are real. But herein lay the rub for Mary Lou. She realized that due to the lengthy absence during her lifetime, they had become just so stories to her, with no experiential knowledge of and little thought devoted to them. When the Pangalang came to Yundamu in 2013, their presence reaffirmed her trust in the strength of Jukurpa, or the dreaming, and simultaneously signaled that she had lost something vital before. During our calls, Mary Lou would often pause and say, "But Yasmin, they're here, they're really here," conveying a jubilant delight, which then immediately became tinged by fear in a logical progression of, if they're here and if they're real, then why are they here? Mary Lou knew for sure that Pangalang steal, kill, and eat children. She had three toddlers in her care and oscillated between excitement and terror. As her emotions swung, our conversations became knotted around the themes of fear, protection, questions about belief, and led to comparative deliberations about Pangalang-like creatures elsewhere, such as the Bigfoot and Yeti, which Mary Lou knew most non-Indigenous people believe are made up and not real. What though, she asked, if Pangalang aren't made up? What if they're real? And then she said, what if they'd just been extinct? The notion of something just having been extinct took me by surprise, especially now that we all live in the Anthropocene, integral to which, as Debbie Bird Rose put it, another quote, is the sixth great extinction event on Earth, the first to be caused by a single species, namely our own. Central Australia offers an excellent example. The rate of mammalian extinction in Central Australia is the highest in the contemporary world. The notion of something just having been extinct begins to make sense when considering the implication of Rose's next sentence. At the same time, much of the region is Aboriginal land, and much of the effort toward preservation and endangered species is collaborative. Extinction is brought to the fore of world pre-consciousness through the recent proliferation of rescue programs in and around Walpri country. For example, New Haven, on Walpri land, named after the pastoral station it was for much of the 20th century, now is run by the non-governmental Australian Wildlife Conservancy. New Haven's status as wildlife sanctuary brings Walpri people back onto country in the form of rangers, trappers, elders, and other such work that they undertake with the settler scientists and land managers there. These trips are experienced as respites, being on country, eating bush tucker, sleeping under the stars rather than in the houses of Yundamu and Nyirpi, but also as first-hand encounters with some of the strange conundrums of living on a damaged planet. New Haven is a place out of whack. At New Haven, Walpri hunters shoot feral cats, but save their kittens. At New Haven, Walpri people encounter and care for translocated threatened species from elsewhere across Australia, including the mullah or rufous hare wallaby, as they replenish their numbers behind the world's largest cat-proof fence, which is 44 kilometres long, made of 85,000 pickets, 400 kilometres of wire, and 130 kilometres of netting. At New Haven, Walpri rangers are engaged in trying to combat the encroachment of weeds into the Tanami, which replace native grasses and alter entire ecosystems. At New Haven, global capitalism, local colonialism, and the ambiguities of settler science and Walpri knowledge of country rub against each other. And even before New Haven and the recent advent of the extinction management industry, Walpri people knew about extinction. Colonization hit the Tanami hard, and in its ongoing aftermath, extinction has been part and parcel of Walpri people's experiences. Consider the common brush-tailed possum. Yundamu is built right next to a possum dreaming track. The hills that you come see when you come into Yundamu, which are called Yundamu Hills, are actually possum hills. And only the most senior Walpri people remember seeing and eating possum. The possums are extinct in Central Australia. In the southern cities of Australia, on the other hand, possums flourish. Mary Lou's understanding of extinction is based on her experiences, seeing possums in abundance in the cities down south, knowing that the mullah being cared for and protected at New Haven are doing well. To make sense of these experiences, she invoked Jukurpa, the dreaming, and its potential to grant absences. Dreamings disappear underground, only to reemerge elsewhere, and the spatial metaphor works temporally as well. Things can disappear at one time, point in time, only to reappear at another. And finally, if plants, animals, humans, weather patterns, and all sorts of things can be threatened by or experience extinction, then why not monsters too? This, Mary Lou triumphantly said, is what happened to the Pankalang. They were gone for a while, and now they're back. But they not only returned, their return changed. In Walpri stories, the gender of Pankalang is not usually explicitly stated, but as many myths portray Pankalang as thieves of Walpri women, it is commonly accepted that Pankalang are male. The Pankalang family that walked past Yundamu was not a lone male Pankalang hunting for human children, as they used to, but a nuclear family, a kin formation new to both Pankalang and Walpri people. Further, they came from the east and moved west in a potent metaphor of reformation. Just as first colonialism and then climate change, both processes steered by the global north, caused the disappearances of possums and mala and all the other extinct and endangered species across Central Australia, including potentially Pankalang, so now came from especially the east. So now, where am I? Return west. They are coming back home, even if changed. As the Pankalang head west past Yundamu, they spatially write their reintegration into Yundamu Wolpi consciousness and into the Jukurpa. West, after all, is where, from a Yundamu-centric perspective, the Wolpi heartland lives, the Tanami. And their path leads to Pankalang in the opposite direction and away from the road that takes people from Yundamu towards town, east to Alice Springs, towards the Australian mainstream and the global north more broadly. I'm just going to have a bit of water and then I'll give you the third one. Okay. The last example is about matter, especially of Jet A fuel used in spaceflight. My case study revolves around a specific rocket plume which came into being on May 25th, 2023. Rocket plumes are visually striking phenomena that are unique in that they are the only direct anthropogenic emissions at high altitudes and in particular in the ozone layer. Their atmospheric impacts, including temporary holes in the ozone layer, are complex and under-researched. I first became aware of this particular rocket plume, not as a rocket plume, but as a strange light that I saw in two photographs posted by Napajari, a Wolpi friend of mine, on Facebook on the night of 25 May 2023. And then I saw it again the next morning, this time in a Facebook post by ABC Darwin. I'm especially interested in the tension. Here, they are both. Between Napajari's description of the plume as a something, where she says something came across the New Haven sky and we saw it, and the ABC posts googly eyes and UFO emoji on the one hand, and the factual explanation provided by the national broadcaster in an interview with a scientific expert. Cohen again assists my reading, particularly his thesis number 3, The Monsters, a Harbinger of Category Crisis, which he introduces as follows, long quote coming up. The monster always escapes because it refuses easy categorization. Of the nightmarish creature that Ridley Scott brought to life in Alien, Harvey Greenberg writes, it is a Linnaean nightmare defying every natural law of evolution. By turns bivalve, crustacean, reptilian, and humanoid. It seems capable of lying dormant with its eggs indefinitely. It sheds its skin like a snake, its carapace like an arthropod. It deposits its young in other species like a wasp. This refusal to participate in the classificatory order of things is true of monsters generally. They're disturbing hybrids whose externally incoherent bodies resist attempts to include them in any systematic structuration. And so the monster is dangerous, a form suspended between forms that threatens to smash distinctions. Considering the monster as a harbinger of category crisis allows us to view the rocket plume variously. Just like the creature in Alien, the plume then is not just part of the technical process of launching satellites into orbit, not just fuel exploding, but also a something, as Napajari calls it, a strange light illuminating the night sky, as well as burning itself into minds and memories, a portent, a wonder. One lesson to be learned from monsters is about how to live with, change with, survive or die in times of planetary crisis. I contour this by attending to three perspectives on Nuri's plume, the rocket was called Nuri, that of Napajari, that of science, and speculatively, by that of the plume itself. Importantly, Napajari take New Haven as the place from where she witnessed and posted. At New Haven, after a day of ranger work, the scientists retire to the houses and the Wolpi rangers congregate around the evening fires. Napajari's post, which I read after she posted it about 3,000 kilometers away in Canberra, transported me to those fires, the stories, the singing, and the jolt that the appearance of the strange light would have caused. Nabu Jari's post says, "Something came across the New Haven night sky and we saw it." The crux here is the word something, just as Ed Bellewin and Beth Povinelli wrote about that. In Central Australia, in Central Australian Aboriginal vernacular, "might be something" is a deeply meaningful phrase pivoting around indeterminacy. Nabu Jari and her co-campers saw something in the night sky. They recorded it and shared their experience on Facebook. This something is, as Nabu Jari posts, both really there and really strange, but what it may or may not mean remains wide open. When things are not the way they should be, say when you hear a nocturnal bird during the day, when a storm cloud travels in a different direction from the others, when you notice a smell that doesn't belong to place, or when you see a strange light in the night sky, Warlpiri people say something might be there, or they whisper cuckoo. Senior people will then investigate and declare whether it is nothing or something, and if so, which particular kind of something or cuckoo. Knowing what kind of monster it is means knowing how to act. Crucial here is the way in which Warlpiri people constantly scan their world for things that are odd, an action you can only perform if you know what things are meant to be like. You need to know the songs of birds, when and where to expect them, when and where they are out of place. You need to know about the paths of the stars during different seasons, about the winds, about tracks, about seeds, about water flows, about dew points. In short, you need to know your world, what it is like when it is right or straight, as only then you can pinpoint what goes against its grain. The presence of monsters can be indicated by signs as subtle as a rustling, or as bold as a rainbow, a whistling screech, unnatural tracks in the sand, or a strange light in the sky. The something witnessed by Nabu Jari and her companions was generated by the boosters of a rocket called Nuri, meaning world in Korean. As the ABC post made clear, there's nothing spooky here. The strange light was caused by human agency, specifically by Nuri, a South Korean rocket, which lifted off at 024 a.m. EDT on May 25, 2023, and successfully deployed 8 satellites into Earth's orbit. The Korean Aerospace Research Institute specifies that, quote, "one of the keys to the development of Nuri is to develop a 75-ton thrust liquid engine and a propellant tank containing fuel and oxidizing agents and accounting for 70 to 80% of the total volume of Nuri." The plume was nothing unusual. In fact, Nuri's third flight was one of more than 6,300 successful rocket launches since 1957 that delivered 14,450 satellites into Earth's orbit. What I would like to put forward, however, is that the plume can also be seen as a representative of, or portent about, exponentially accelerated human activity in space. Among other things, this involves an export of Earth matter into space, including the fuel combusted, such as in Nuri's booster flume. And do note that the aviation's industry jet kerosene demands have increased to more than 5% of all refined products derived from crude. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the strange light was not the fuel plume of Nuri's booster. What I'm saying is that it is this, and it is something. If nothing else, it is a sign that things are not straight. What is a monster if not something? Our English word monster means portent, and shouldn't we read Nuri's plume as a portent? At night in Central Australia, you can see the Milky Way spin on its axis. In the 1990s at Yundamu, sometimes when someone in camp was awake around 3 a.m., when the Sydney to Singapore jumbo jet flew straight across Yundamu, they'd wake me up, gently touching my shoulder and whispering, "Look, Yasmin, Qantas," while pointing at the moving and blinking dot above us. I also remember how we'd point out satellites to each other when they came across the Yundamu night sky. Today in Central Australia, you can see not only the Milky Way, but every meteorite, every plane, every satellite, and every rocket fuel plume. Gazing at the stars in Central Australia You witness how busy it is up there now. Today it is impossible to look up and not see man-made objects crisscross above. Constantly scanning your world for things that are odd means noticing and contemplating the meaning of not just the extraordinary plume, but also the busyness up there. And while the ABC's rationalization of science versus googly-eyed UFO theories tries to explain that busyness away, shouldn't we not also pay attention to what it means that Earth matter is up there? The Walbury lesson is to think of the rocket fuel plume as something that came to be in a place where it is not meant to be, to see Nuri's rocket plume literally as matter out of place. Jet A fuel is made out of crude oil. It is former life, dead organisms such as plankton and algae, subjected to prolonged heat and pressure over millennia, burning up, exploding in space, a long way away from home, burning bright, signaling home to Earth one last time. If we see the plume like that, then it becomes a magnificent portent, a brightly shining, eerie light that says, think about what it means for the planet that I exist.
Okay, very short conclusion.
Levina and Bui stated, and this was 10 years ago, in the past decade, our rapidly changing world faced terrorism, global epidemics, economic and social strife, new communication technologies, migration and climate change, to name a few. While monsters always tapped into anxieties over a changing world, they have never been as popular or as needed as in the past decade. This need, I propose, has only increased. I hope to have shown that as anthropologists, we should take serious what haunts our interlocutors, as that also shows what haunts the world. My examples have included how Jamba thrive in the settler colony and as a result increase their preying on Walbury lives. I've shown how the return of the Pankalung brings to the fore not only ontological and religious questions, but also highlights the conundrums of living in an age of extinction. And last, the something, or Korean rocket fuel kuku, can be understood as a portent of planetary concerns caused as they are by the global north. And while these are but three of a myriad examples, I hope they show not just how intricately everything is entangled, but how you can see even more entanglements if you do look at monsters. In this case, entanglements of the global north, the Central Australian night sky, Walbury mortality rates, extinction, resource waste, us, them, and importantly to my analysis, the monsters that contour the crises that mark our times. Thank you.